Junk Food Dinner, Episode 22. This week we devote an entire episode to one of our all-time favorite films, Freaked, from 1993. We discuss the finer details of the stylized cult comedy and recall our own personal experiences with the film. We also have an exclusive interview with writer, director, and star of Freaked, Mr. Alex Winter.
I don't know how to repay you for this.
You could wipe my ass.
Welcome to Junk Food Dinner, Episode 22. This is the podcast where each week we scour the internet, video stores, and cable television, looking for the most outrageous and interesting cult films. We're not professional film journalists or critics by any means. We are simply three geeks from Ohio with entirely too much time on our hands. I'm Kevin Moss. I'm joined by my co-hosts Mark Fredo and Parker Bowman, and our special guest host this week, Christopher Olvis. Every week, we'll each bring a cult favorite to the table, recalling our personal experiences with the film, discussing its merits, and arguing why or why we did not enjoy it. This week is dedicated to the 1993 cult comedy film Freaked, and we had a chance to sit down with one of the film's writers, directors, and star, Mr. Alex Winter, who was nice enough to sit down and talk with us, so we'll have a nice lengthy interview with him following our review of the movie. But first, how are you guys doing this week?
I'm good.
Good.
Yeah, I'm also good.
Yeah, Mark, welcome back. You spent a long couple weeks out in the wilderness in the summer.
Braving canoes and zip lines and camp food.
Shaping young hearts and minds.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so you had a good time out there?
Yeah, it was a blast. It was fun. Got to hang out with a lot of cool kids and a lot of cool friends who I don't get to see all that often. So it was a blast. It's good to be back though.
Excellent. Christopher, thanks again for joining us again on this show. For those of you listening, Christopher joined us on our last episode where we discussed They Live, The Mac, and The Brain. And he's back again to talk about Freaked with us for this little bonus episode. So thank you for taking some time out and joining us again this week. Really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, I'm excited to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for picking all those movies I like while I was gone, too. I don't know if we talked about that at all.
Well, we looked at your Facebook where it lists your favorite movies, and we just went off of that to decide what to do
while you were gone. Oh, perfect. Let's do Straw Dogs. Fuck that guy.
But yeah, you like that movie?
Yeah, I'm over the moon for it.
All right. Well, because this is a special episode dedicated to Freak, we're going to forego the nerd news and DVD portions of the show, as if you want that information for this week, just look right below and you should see episode 21 where we get into all that good stuff with Mr. Olvis, and go ahead and listen to that if you haven't done so already. But we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to jump right in to the feature for this week, 1993's Freaked. So stick around and we will get this baby cooking.
You're cooking a baby?
Yeah. You never wanna, but you're gonna be the freak of the week. You never wanna, but you're gonna be the freak of the week. You never wanna, but you're gonna be the freak of the week. You never wanna, but you're gonna be the freak of the week.
Elijah C. Scuggs, freak show tycoon, an amateur bioengineer.
I can look at a guy like K.
Kevin Costner and see a giant peach grub.
When fate brought them together, Mr. Scuggs took an average Hollywood slime ball and made something out of them.
Oh, God! This was my good side!
20th Century Fox presents Freaked. It's about friendship.
I thought I told you to shut up!
Loyalty.
I say we kill him!
Life's big questions.
How many feminists does it take to screw in a light bulb?
Oh! Show business.
The public does not want to see disgusting, depraved, violent film.
And I suppose Jake and the Fat Man was just a fluke.
It's about state-of-the-art technology. It's about Mr. T's the bearded lady.
I am woman. Now like me.
It's about Bobcat Goldthwait as a son.
It's the end of the world! The apocalypse!
Ah! It'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry.
And it'll make a cool sore that you thought had healed up start bugging you again.
It's the kind of film Brooke Shields has always wanted to do.
Oh.
Introducing Larry Bud Melman as the President of the United States.
What's the matter? Try your little rock star.
In Freaked, coming soon to a theater. Freaked, but ugly, but funny.
Welcome to show business, morons.
All right, welcome back to Junk Food Dinner, episode number 22. We are going to jump right into our special feature this week. This show is going to be all about the 1993 comedy cult classic film Freaked. Now, this movie was originally under the working title of Hideous Mutant Freaks for a long time before it met a very inauspicious post-production budget cut, which left the film with a very small release in theaters, only making a measly $29,000 gross revenue, which is far below its $12 million budget. However, despite the fact that it got such a limited release, it did get quite a cult following once it hit the shelves of video stores and late-night cable television. People were really drawn to its wacky style, irreverent humor, and a slew of great casting choices. But this movie was a labor of love for the directors Tom Stern and Alex Winter, and was written by Stern, Winter, and Tim Burns. The three of them, prior to this, had been involved in many projects together on certain levels, but were probably most known at the time for their work on the MTV show The Idiot Box. And a lot of the visual style and humor that you would see in an episode of The Idiot Box was transferred over to their full-length feature, Freaked. The story basically revolves around a spoiled Hollywood kind of brat pack kind of guy named Ricky Coogan, played by Alex Winter, who is he was the star of, as they mentioned, films like Ghost Dude and things like that. Ricky
and Robo Dude as well.
Yeah, Ricky is offered a job as a spokesman for a controversial fertilizer called Zygrot 24, which is being pitched by a South American company in Santa Flan that wants him to go to Santa Flan in South America and promote the deadly fertilizer as their, you know, as their poster boy. So Ricky and his buddy Ernie, who is played by Michael Stoyanov, who most people will remember as Blossom's brother on the show Blossom, he's his wacky, you know, sidekick. He's always cracking wise and getting into trouble. They fly to South America to promote the controversial fertilizer. When the guys get there, they are met with a group of protesters protesting the environmental effects of Zygrot 24. They are led by the cute young environmentalist Julie, played by Megan Ward. Quickly, Ricky and Ernie decide to con their way into Julie's heart by playing a injured person wrapped in bandages. And so they team up, and they're driving along the countryside in South America, and they come across a freak show, and they decide to check it out just for a goof. When they get there, they meet the proprietor of the freak show, Elijah C. Scuggs, played absolutely wonderfully by the great actor Randy Quaid. But when they get there, they quickly realize that the freaks at this show are not just there by happenstance. They're actually there being created by Elijah C. Scuggs with his secret chemical, Zygrot 24. So quickly, Julie, Ernie, and Ricky are all captured and turned into freaks using the Zygra 24. Julie and Ernie are conjoined at the waist to make a half-man, half-woman freak, and Ricky is turned into the Beast Boy. However, Elijah only has just enough to complete about half of the Beast Boy, so Ricky is damned to have half of his body freakishly mutated and half of his body still the same. They're thrown into a deluxe outhouse that is much larger than it appears from the outside, where they're introduced to a whole host of other wacky freaks that are imprisoned by the evil Elijah Scuggs, and they're forced to perform on a regular basis for the paying public. So after that, we are given a whole lot of sight gags and jokes, you know, all based around the freaks. There's a lot of really cool visual style to it, some great music, and a lot of really irreverent comedy, a lot of in the same style as like The Naked Gun or Blazing Saddle, Mel Brooks kind of movies.
Some would say When Nature Calls.
Yeah. And so so a lot of like really outrageous sight gags and kind of some gross out humor, but all really funny as we see the freaks band together and try to rise up against the evil Elijah C. Scuggs. Now, this has been one of my favorite movies for a long time. I caught this originally when it played on HBO back when I was in junior high school, and I just immediately fell in love with it. Just the wacky visual style and the brand of humor was right up my alley as an adolescent kid. I mean, it, you know, quickly became my favorite movie, and it kind of introduced me to the idea of a cult film and, you know, just the fact that I really love this movie and not a lot of people had heard about it. And I was always trying to, you know, tell people about it, and anybody that would listen, I would be like, have you seen this movie, Freaked? It's unbelievable. And it kind of was like my own thing. It was like this movie that I really loved that not a lot of people had heard about, so it just made me like it even more. You know, I always sought out any type of, you know, information or anything I could get on it, and was always searching the internet. I bought the VHS, which wasn't available for commercial release, so I had to pay like the rental price, which was like $40 or $50 just for the VHS tape, which, you know, especially when you're a teenager, it seems like, you know, a pirate ransom and and money. But, you know, I happily did it just because I love this movie so much. But yeah, what do you guys think of this film?
I absolutely love this movie. All the things that you just said about it, I also did that and feel the same way.
Yeah.
I had a VHS tape with this and True Romance, and I wore it the fuck out. Like, the tape broke in half from watching it so many times. And much like you, I got my hands on a video copy, a video store in my hometown of Heber Heights closed down, and they had this on the shelf for like a measly sum, and I quickly snatched it up, and I've been coveting it ever since. And yeah, I just love it. It's one of those things that shaped the way I would feel about comedy when I was in, you know, sixth or seventh grade, whenever I saw it. And, you know, I wanted to grow up and write movies like this and write things like this and do things like this. And it's just so great. And it shaped my young little mind to a huge extent. Like, I was a big fan of Bill and Ted, and then that's what got me into this movie. And then, like, after seeing this movie, I was like, yeah, Bill and Ted, they're still great, but man, Freaked is where it's at. Why isn't, you know, Freaked on shirts everywhere? Why aren't people, you know, why isn't Ricky Coogan on shirts, and why aren't there any Ricky Coogan bobbleheads and stuff like this?
Right.
Yeah, this was, I mean, I absolutely agree with you guys. This was a sleepover standard, you know, in junior high and even the first couple years of high school. We just watched this all the time, and, you know, it has pretty much everything I love. Puns, you know, lots of sight gags, the Butthole Surfers, Gibby Haynes cameo. Like, it really is just like everything you want in a movie when you're that age. And it just, I think it just kind of hit all of us at the exact right time.
Right. Yeah. I think we're all like in the 28 to 30 range. And I think people our age, I think it was, yeah, specifically designed for our mindsets.
Yeah. It was, I mean, it was just the exact right time for this. And I mean, it made me wish I had seen it, you know, in the theater and stuff, but
you would have been like one of 20 people to see it in the theater.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I still love it. And I rewatched this yesterday because I decided that, you know, I still hate packing even after not doing it for a week. So I was like, well, I better do something responsible, like watch Freaked for the podcast. So I watched it again after not having seen it in a long time. And it was every bit as good as I remember it. You know, the effects are awesome. I think the costumes are amazing.
Yeah, the makeup in it is great.
Yeah. Yeah, everything about it is is just fantastic. And it's, you know, it's not like terribly long and the pacing's great. And I don't know, it's just gushing about this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everything that you guys have been saying is spot on, basically. And what I was even talking to Fredo about earlier too, he just mentioned the pacing and how the movie keeps going along and they don't like have a lot of reoccurring jokes that just bog down the movie and slow it down. Like there's constantly a lot of different things that they're throwing at you visually and aesthetically and everything. So
yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of these jokes are fairly obvious. You know what I mean? Like the setup, you know, you know what joke is coming, but it's still hysterical. Like it's executed well. And I think that probably also comes with having seen it when I was younger and you know, feeling a different way about comedy now than I did then, but still, I don't know. I guess when I was younger, maybe I didn't expect the setups quite as much, but
yeah,
it just really holds up, I think.
Yeah. Now let's talk about some of the cast in this movie, because this movie has a real eclectic cast of people either you'll know right away or people that if you saw their face or heard their voice, you would definitely recognize them. Of course, we've got Alex Winter playing Ricky Coogan. He was best known, obviously, as Bill from the Bill and Ted movies. He was also in Lost Boys. And he's a real recognizable face. And like I said, he's the writer and director of this movie as well. And we have a really good interview with him coming up. But also, like I said, we have Michael Stoyanov as Ernie from Blossom. Megan Ward as Julie, who a lot of people would probably remember from PCU and a few other movies. She was, it seems like, all over the place in the 90s.
In Glory Days. She was in Glory Days.
All right. Yeah, which we'll be talking about next week. So make sure you tune in for that.
Keeping it tied together.
Yeah. Randy Quaid as Elijah C. Scuggs. I think this is probably his best role ever.
Oh, he's fantastic.
And I say that without even like the slightest bit of irony or sarcasm, because just the look he has in this movie, he's got like long gray hair and kind of like this Colonel Sanders beard. And
yeah, his costumes, like the outfits that he wears are pretty incredible. He looks pretty amazing.
Yeah. You've got Bobcat Goldthwait as the voice of Sockhead, who's a freak who's... his deformity is he's got a sock puppet for a head, which is has some hilarious jokes around it as well. You've got Keanu Reeves, Ted from Bill and Ted, playing the Ortiz the dog boy. Now, he actually was uncredited in this movie, and we got into a little bit about that in the interview, which you'll hear later. You've got Mr. T as the bearded lady, which is, you know, just some of the most hilarious casting that you could think of. You've got William Sadler, who was Death in the Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. He's playing the sleazy EES executive, Dick Bryan. You've got Alex Zuckerman, a kid actor, playing Stewie Gluck, who is kind of like this super fan of Ricky Coogan's, who constantly stalks and harasses him, and eventually forms a very special telepathic bond with Ricky. he's most notable to me for playing Rod Stewart's redheaded child companion in the Forever Young video. You ever seen that? It's pretty creepy.
Yeah, you are watching that all the time.
I am, yeah. But then you've got cameos by people like Brooke Shields, who plays a television host named Sky Daly, who's interviewing Ricky about his experience. You've got Morgan Fairchild as a stewardess. You've got all kinds of people just popping up. Larry Bud Melman.
Gibby Haynes.
Sam Raimi has appearance as a crooked cop, and tons of really cool casting choices, and I think that all really works out in their favor, just because everybody in this movie is like hilarious and just really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Great opening credits sequence, great soundtrack. During the like freak making scene when they do like the claymation changing, like morphing of the guys, and they have the like the Tyrannosaurus and the Cyclops from Voyage of Sinbad and stuff. It's just a lot of really awesome references that are current for the time of the movie and, you know, from movies past. And it's just, yeah, it's just a nice little collection of all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, like I said, the lot of the jokes in this movie are set up in a very satirical way in the vein of the Naked Gun kind of movies. There's a lot of like just ridiculous sight gags that happen. For example, one of my favorite jokes in the movie is when they're flying to Santa Flan. You see the plane come in and then it just bursts into flames, And then you see them in the background saying, "Oh, glad, I'm sure glad that wasn't our plane," you know, like stuff like that. And
a lot of great physical
humor. And yeah, it's just super hilarious. And even now, I mean, you know, a lot of us discovered this movie, as we mentioned, as adolescents, and the humor is very sophomoric in a lot of ways, but it still holds up great to this day. I mean, as an adult, I can still watch this and crack up, even though I've seen this movie, you know, well over 50 plus times. It still makes me laugh out loud. So I mean, I think that's a testament to how good the humor is in this movie.
Yeah, it holds up so well. Like, it's so funny still. Like, a lot of stuff that I liked from this era is sort of now coming about on DVD, like The State came out, Parker Lewis Can't Lose, a lot of the stuff that I was into when I was into this, and some of that stuff doesn't really hold up nearly as well as you remember it. And Freaked is, I mean, I laugh as hard watching it now as I do, or as I did the first time I watched it.
Right.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the jokes work well, but I think they work well in the context of the movie because of, like, the awesome makeup and the crazy sets and the costumes and just, you know, the way it's so over the top. I think that helps sell the humor. Whereas if it were in, you know, a movie without that kind of aesthetic, those jokes would kind of fall flat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it was just kind of like a teenage comedy or like a college comedy with these same type of jokes, yeah. I don't think it would work as well. But exactly. Since it's set in this just really bizarre, visually stylistic world, I think it that really lends itself well to the humor. And you don't really see too much of that. I mean, it's one of those movies that really blends comedy, horror, and sci-fi, and cult elements all in a really unique way. And I think that's why it's one of my favorite movies, because it does blend all those styles so well. It's not a straight, you know, sci-fi or horror movie, and it's not a straight comedy. It's, you know, a little bit of everything mixed in, which is awesome.
Definitely.
Yeah, when I was a youngster, I had a subscription to Fangoria magazine, and I remember Freaked being in one of those magazines. And I remember thinking, but why is Freaked in here? Like, it's a comedy. Like, it's not a horror movie. And, like, you know, like, so much of what you see is, it has to be just one thing. Like, you know, this movie's just funny, or this movie's just scary, or this movie's just action, or what, you know. And this is one of the first things that I encountered that I, you know, really enjoyed that was, you know, it blended a lot of different elements and took from different genres and things. And it blew my mind that something could be more than just, you know, a cookie cutter genre.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the special makeup effects that are in this movie, because I think that's definitely one of the shining points of this movie and one of the things that really gives it that unique visual style. First and foremost, we have, you know, Ricky Coogan, who has half of his body transformed into this hideous beast boy, which looks kind of like a Basil Wolverton drawing, or, you know, just something totally outrageous. It's, you know, just this green, slimy, bulgy eyes and big, floppy, reptilian-looking ears. And he's got, you know, half his mouth just gaping open and dripping with saliva at all times. And that's really cool. He's got, like, this huge hump coming out of his shoulder and these green, veiny hands, which, you know, it's probably my favorite piece of makeup effects in the movie. I mean, it just looks so good and it's so seamless because, you know, the other half of his body is totally normal. So it blends really well, that, you know, the half man, half beast kind of look. And I think that looks really awesome.
Yeah, that makeup's really good. I think the human worm makeup deserves
it. Oh, yeah.
Because that is absolutely seamless. That looks totally amazing. And I also really like the Rastafari. Their mouths, I think, are pretty. They just look great. Everything looks awesome, you know.
Yeah, Elijah Scuggs has these two henchmen that are Rasta eyeballs called I and I, which just that joke alone is fucking great. Yeah,
exactly.
And yeah, they're like smoking huge spliffs and shooting machine guns and stuff, and it's just two midgets in eyeball costumes. But oh my god, it's so great. But yeah, Elijah also has this really cool kind of henchman called Toad, who's like this hulking guy that has like this toad makeup painted green with like warts on him. And he has some really cool effects where he eats a rabbit with his tongue. There's also a creature named Cowboy, who's just literally a cow with cowboy clothing on. That's really cool effects.
So good.
Yeah, there's Nosy the Nose Man, who is just, you know, a guy with a giant nose. And then there's all these kind of like weirdo, like not so much special effects driven freaks, but just kind of like sight gag freaks. Like there's this guy called the Eternal Flame, who's literally just a guy who's constantly farting a big flame out of his ass. There's like we mentioned, Mr. T as the bearded lady, Bobcat Goldthwait as Sockhead. And then we have Rosie the Pinhead, who is just a bald woman who's kind of reminiscent to the pinheads in Todd Browning's Freaks. And then we have the Hideous Frogman, which, despite his name, is literally just a guy in a scuba suit. So
he speaks French.
Right, yeah. So he's just a French scuba diver.
Yeah, pretty fun.
I love that frog, man. He might be my favorite freak.
One of my favorite jokes was when they're doing all of the like freaks' backstories, when they're like getting acquainted, right. And they're just like panning over, and they're like flashing back to how they became these freaks, and they flash over to that hammer.
Yeah.
And the hammer used to be a wrench, and then Elijah turned it into a hammer. I thought that was super funny. And that was one that I had actually forgotten about. So when I watched it yesterday, I was just cracking up.
Yeah, that is probably my favorite joke in this movie. I fucking love that hammer.
that supporting actor.
You got that right. Also, when we were talking about the freaks, we left out Paul Lynde's skeleton.
Oh yeah. God, that was another one of my favorite jokes.
Yeah, the way they introduce the freaks at the beginning, they do this parody of Hollywood Squares, and they, you know, each freak is in their own square, and in the center square is the skeleton of Paul Lynde, and represented by, you know, a skeleton puppet with a limp wrist, which is hilarious.
Yeah. Also, when they're doing the freak show, they make a joke about like if there's other sensitive people in the audience. You know, they should leave immediately. And the two effeminate guys that get up and leave, I think, are actually Alex Winter and Tom Stern.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is real funny, too. So the jokes just keep coming.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's literally just, you know, a joke a minute in this movie, and they're all pretty hilarious. And a lot of them are sight gags. Like at the beginning, the EES businessman is trying to convince Ricky Coogan of the, you know, how Zygarde 24 is not dangerous, and he brings in this expert by the name of George Ramirez, and as he's talking, he continually shrinks smaller and smaller, and that cracks me up as well.
even the jokes that aren't, I don't know, even the jokes that aren't funny at least elicit like a chuckle and a groan.
Right.
So that's still worth it to me. Like, that's still a winner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think some of my favorite jokes in this movie are things that aren't even jokes, and they're not even things that if you told somebody about them that they would be funny, like, at all. Like, you know, the freaks do this freak show / talent show for people for money. And Nosey the Nose Man, who's got this huge nose that's like the size of several heads, his talent show thing is that he gets into a gorilla suit and dances.
Right. You can't even see the nose under the gorilla costume.
Yeah, how he would fit the gorilla head over his nose is perplexing. And then the fact that these people come to this freak show to pay to see freaks, and then they're under a gorilla costume is ridiculous.
Yeah. The best kind of jokes.
Yeah. But yeah, this movie is just super hilarious, and it only gets better upon repeat viewings. Another thing that's really cool is the set design in this movie is really colorful and very cartoonish, and I think that lends itself well. Especially the design of Elijah C. Scuggs' Freakland. He has a huge rotating statue of his own head where the eyeballs are, as we mentioned before, the I and I characters. You know, just real comically cartoonish, colorful, like circus tents, and, you know, all the costumes are very colorful as well. There's just like the color just like jumps off the screen in this movie. And it's not, you know, not a dark or, you know, like monotone movie. It's very bright and in your face, which I think also lends itself well to the irreverent style of this movie.
Yeah, I think it kind of falls in line with stuff like Terrorvision and Forbidden Zone, and even kind of Meet the Hollowheads in that respect.
Absolutely. And those are, you know, a lot of my favorite just visually style of movies, where the irreverence of the movie is really portrayed in the color and the costumes and the makeup design of the movie. And I think this movie really, really has that in spades. You know, like I said, I saw this movie when I was a kid, and I instantly became obsessed with it. I mean, I think this was probably one of my first cinematic obsessions. I mean, I still to this day have drawings that I drew of it in high school art class. I went as far as to I actually tracked down Tom Stern online, and this was in the early days of the internet, and started like an email correspondence with him, and he mailed me a VHS tape of the director's cut of Freaked with all the deleted scenes still left in and stuff. And he also had a bunch of the shorts that he and Alex Winter had worked on together, like Squeal of Death, this like kind of raunchy short film that they did for, I think it was like HBO or Showtime, called Meals on Wheels, where it was basically Alex Winter chasing this woman on roller skates and like trying to have sex with her. And it was just really raunchy, but it, you know, kind of in that same style as Freaked, and but really funny. And so that was really cool, like to have like a personal connection with him on that level. And now, you know, getting a chance to talk to Alex Winter, it's, you know, kind of come full circle. So yeah, I mean, this movie just, this is just cementing this movie as, you know, one of my top favorite things of all time.
Yeah. The first time I actually met you, Kevin, we were both used to be roommates in the dorms, and this you introduced this movie to me the first night we met. I fell in love.
Yeah, that was kind of like my litmus test to see if my new roommate was going to be cool or not. I was like, we'll watch Freak together, and if he reacts poorly to it, it's going to be a rough year. But fortunately, you dug it, and we've been friends ever since. So,
Parker, are you crying?
Yeah, I'm gently weeping. I just love this movie so much.
Such a beautiful story.
I was thinking about how Ricky Coogan and that hideous troll were soulmates. It always makes me tear up.
Now, for a long time, this movie was very hard to come by. Like I said, it got a very... And we talked about this in the interview with Alex, but yeah, after the movie had done finishing shooting, the post-production budget was cut severely. There was new studio executives that took over 20th Century Fox, and apparently they didn't like Freaked very much and were upset that $12 million had already been spent on this thing. So kind of in retaliation, they cut the post-production budget, which left it with a very small theatrical run, and you know, they didn't release it on home video for purchase, only for rental, which left a lot of people not being able to obtain this movie. And one of the worst things to come out of the post-production cuts were the soundtrack cuts. The soundtrack itself, as it is still pretty good. There's, you know, the cuts by the Butthole Surfers and Henry Rollins with Blind Idiot God, and Parliament Funkadelic has a song specifically written for the movie. But Alex Winter actually told us that I guess they had tracks by Iggy Pop and Red Hot Chili Peppers that were written specifically for the movie as well that they didn't get to license because of their post-production cuts. But nevertheless, like I said, the movie, I saw it mostly on HBO. It seemed like they played it quite a bit, and you know, that's where I first got introduced to it. But fortunately, not too long ago, a few years back, they released a special two-disc edition DVD of this movie by Anchor Bay, which I immediately snapped up the day it came out, and which is awesome because, you know, this movie was so kind of unknown to a lot of people. It was amazing that it got a DVD release, let alone a two-disc special edition, which is great. And the special edition has a lot of deleted scenes, like those ones that I had mentioned that I had seen on that VHS tape that I had gotten earlier. It has, you know, director's commentary with Alex Winter and Tom Stern, and a lot of cool stuff. And they the director's commentary sheds a lot of really interesting light on, you know, what it took to make this movie and how the makeup effects were done. And, you know, we got to give a lot of credit to the makeup effects artist Screaming Mad George, who kind of helmed a lot of the makeup effects. He gave this movie a really cool visual style, which I think, you know, is one of the things that really sets this apart from a lot of the other kind of goofball comedies that came out around the same time.
Definitely.
Yeah, unfortunately, I actually think that the DVD, the Anchor Bay DVD of this, is actually out of print now, which is unfortunate. But you can still watch it. It's on Watch Instantly on Netflix, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's still floating out there. So if you haven't seen this movie, I would definitely recommend watching it immediately. And
yeah, that's
falling in love.
Yeah, pretending you're, 13 and just watching this.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I don't even think you need to be 13 to enjoy this. I mean, I certainly think that helps. It'll connect to that young sensibility. But I think people of any age can watch this, and I probably have a good time with it.
Especially super old people.
Yeah. Super old people.
Just super old.
Yeah. Well, they laugh at everything anyway. They don't know what's going on.
Yeah, there were actually some interesting promotional tie-ins to this movie when it originally came out. There's a comic book that was released, just a one-issue comic book that I have, which is pretty funny. And it was actually kind of based on the original Hideous Mutant Freak script, so there's some jokes in there that were obviously from the original script that didn't make it into the movie, so that's kind of cool to see. Although there are some like changes to like some, you know, basic plot points of the movie, which are kind of weird. Also, there was a novelization of this movie. No shit.
Totally necessary.
Yeah, a guy named Todd Strasser penned a novelization of this movie, and you can find it for like $2 on Amazon. So I recommend picking that up if you're a fan of this movie. Also, Suncoast Video released a line of action figures for this movie. One of the biggest regrets in my life is not buying it. I actually worked at Suncoast Video, and we had them like discounted for like $2 each.
Oh, you sucked.
I don't know what the fuck was wrong with me. I don't know. I mean, I was buying a lot of weed at the time, but I don't know why I didn't purchase those goddamn action figures. And now it haunts me because I look for them, and they pop up like once a year on eBay and always for like $50 each. And I'm like, ah!
There's probably a girl there that you liked, so you couldn't buy action figures.
There's probably a lot of truth to that. I was probably trying to be a little bit too... But it didn't stop me from buying any other... ridiculous shit that Suncoast Video offered. Like, half my paycheck would go to, you know, like Fargo t-shirts and shit. So I don't know why I didn't.
What's the one that you would buy if you were gonna get one on eBay?
Well, they have the Julie Ernie, they have the cowboy, they have the Beast Boy Ricky Coogan, obviously, and I want to say that and Ortiz the Dog Boy. I'd probably get the Beast Boy. I mean, that's, you know, he's the main dude, and I think his figure looks the best.
I have the Hammer action figure that I would happily still give for $50.
Is it just a regular Hammer?
No. It's definitely from the movie.
Do you know who put out the original action figures?
They were put out by Suncoast Video, actually.
That's so weird.
Yeah. But yeah, so yeah, I mean, needless to say, I was obsessed with this movie as a kid, and I still love it to this day. I try to watch this at least, you know, once a month just to boost my spirits, you know. It's like if I'm ever having like a bad week or something, I can throw this movie on and it'll instantly cheer me up. It's that good. I mean, I don't think we're overselling this at all. I think anyone that loves just irreverent humor and great visual aesthetic and great makeup effects, I think, would dig this movie.
Absolutely.
All right, so that just about wraps up Freaked for us. Now we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to jump in to our lengthy interview. Parker and I had a chance to sit down with the man behind Freaked himself, Alex Winter, and we'll get some great insights into the movie. So stick around. We'll be right back, and we'll be talking with Alex Winter himself on Junk Food Dinner. All right, so this is Kevin Moss. I'm with Parker Bowman. We're here with Junk Food Dinner, and we are sitting down and talking with Mr. Alex Winter, writer, director, actor extraordinaire. It's a huge pleasure to talk to you, sir. Thank you for being with us.
No sweat. Great to talk to you guys.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your background. You're born in London, is that correct?
Yes, I was born in England, and I moved to the States when I was about four. So I mostly grew up in the U.S., but I've been bouncing back and forth between the UK and the States most of my life. So,
yeah, you still have family there, or?
Yeah, and I direct a lot of TV commercials, and I'd spent a lot of time between around 1994 and 2004, about 10 years shooting with a company that I was part of in London, and it was really great. I still go back to do work there from time to time, but I've been so busy with my longer form stuff that I've been doing a lot less of that.
Yeah. And so at what point did kind of you get into acting? Was that something you were doing as a child or?
Yeah, I started acting as a kid. My first love, even as a kid, was always directing. And but I was acting as a child actor. I worked on Broadway and off Broadway all through my early teens, all the way through my teens, from basically 12 until 17. I was on Broadway and off Broadway, and then I graduated high school and I went to NYU Film School for directing and writing. And then I got out of film school and was broke, you know, because I'd been in film school for 4 years. And film school is expensive; they don't pay for a lot of your movies.
Right. You know.
So, and I was always like crazily ambitious and making, I mean, most film students are, they like go in thinking they're going to be, you know, D.W. Griffith and they end up going broke just like D.W. Griffith did. So, kind of have the whole D.W. Griffith experience in a truncated 4-year form, without making any masterpieces. But, so I did that and then I still had an acting agent. So I was looking for dough and, I ended up in a bunch of movies, which was kind of somewhat of an accidental career.
Yeah. Now, in college is where you met Tom Stern, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And what kind of brought you guys together? I mean, were you both in the film department? Did you just share similar interests?
We were both, Tom and I were both at NYU Film School. We were both undergrads. We were both in the same freshman year class, and we both shared a mutual contempt for our teacher. And who was really pretentious. And so we started realizing that we were making the same kinds of movies. And then we were like, because we were both crazily ambitious, we're like, well, why don't we pull our resources and make movies together? Then we can double our resources and make big, even bigger movies. So we started working together our freshman year of college, which was 1983. And we worked together nonstop until 1992. Wow. And, it was a crazy run. We still do some stuff together from time to time that we sort of, you know, we both have gone off in different creative directions, but we're very close and we still, you know, dabble in some stuff together. But we just worked in a very concentrated form as a directing and writing team for that period through college and then after college.
Now, it was the two of you that decided to kind of go from New York to California together, or was that something, you know, you wanted to do on your own? And
no, I was already I started acting before I graduated. Well, I didn't ever graduate. I actually left NYU because I was working so much in the film business that I was already in the business that I was going to college to get into. So I left to keep working. I was pretty much done with school by then, but I had started going to LA. I acted in Death Wish 3 between my sophomore and junior year at NYU. It was a hilarious – that's how I spent my summer vacation, was playing a Puerto Rican rapist. and then between my junior and senior year, I was in Lost Boys. I think that's right. I get all mucked up on dates. But anyway, he moved out after he finished school. I was already out in LA by then.
Okay.
Is that when you started working on The Idiot Box, or how did that come about?
No, I mean, you guys don't have time for this story. The very short version, very short version, is that we made a movie at NYU called Squeal of Death. And Squeal of Death attracted the attention of an executive at Columbia Pictures who said, come out to Hollywood and I'll give you a big movie deal. So we packed up our car. I had an apartment in L.A., but I was still based in New York. We packed up our car, moved to L.A., and we're like, we're in L.A., let's get Variety, which is like the newspaper for the movie business, because now we're going to be moguls, you know. Front page of Variety was that the chairman of Columbia had been fired. So we had no movie deal.
Yeah.
And so we set about writing a bunch of movies, and Sam Raimi had we had sent him Squeal of Death, and he'd become a big fan of it, and he had wanted to do some movies with us, so as a producer. So we wrote a bunch of really, really over-the-top, irreverent movies that Sam and his partner Rob shopped around Hollywood and couldn't get any bites on. And one of those was an anthology comedy that was really, really – it was like Kentucky Fried Movie gone even more over the edge.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get anyone to bite it. So after Bill and Ted's success, MTV came to me and asked me to be their guest VJ as Bill for 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that's – sounds like hell on earth. that was what I was thinking. What I said was, I thank you very much for the kind offer. But how about you guys let us have a TV show instead? And we took that anthology comedy that we couldn't get sold, and we reworked that into The Idiot Box. And that was how The Idiot Box came about. And Freaked was really kind of The Idiot Box movie because, you know, by then Bill and Ted had come out and gained notoriety, and The Idiot Box was a hit and it was gaining us notoriety. We decided to like take the tone of The Idiot Box, the same writers, creators, and put it into a feature. And that was Freaked.
Excellent. Yeah. I've actually seen Squeal of Death. In the late 90s, I hooked up with Tom via email, and he sent me a videotape with that on it and Meals on Wheels and some of the other stuff you guys did. And that was really cool.
Oh, great. Yeah, Meals on Wheels was a lot of fun. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we were just doing, all these sort of short films, music videos. We were directing music, a lot of music videos, and but mostly we were writing movies, you know, and working on trying to get these things off the ground, and then Freak was sort of the culmination of finally getting that voice out there.
Yeah, what was the environment like in Hollywood when you got the deal for Freaked? I mean, I would have to imagine it's a lot different than what it is now.
Well, I mean, Hollywood is Hollywood. You know, the thing is there is no they. You know, it's like there's a continual rotation of chairmen at studios. And, you know, the bottom line is the only difference is there was no South Park yet. There was no Tim Burton yet. So there really wasn't anyone doing anything on a popular level that was that far out from a comedy standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And the studios just didn't know what the hell to do with it. I mean, I think that had our studio chairman that we made it for remained at the studio, it would have at least been widely released.
Yeah.
But they really didn't know what to do with it. To be fair to them, it was crazily off the wall. You know, I'd love to sit here and go, you know, we made Godfather 2 and they're mad for not giving us a wide release. But it wasn't. It was this bananas movie with no precedent. And they didn't know what to do with it, simply. It was terrifying to them. So, you know, now, sure, I don't know how much easier it'd be to make Freak. I don't think it's ever easy to make a movie that cuts completely against the grain of what everyone's doing. But I certainly am damn glad we got it. You know, it was a happy accident. We managed to skate through with a completed movie. If the chairman had been, you know, had left that studio 6 months earlier, we wouldn't have even finished the film. So it's in my mind, it's a happy accident. That's sort of the factual record. I mean, I became friendly with Matt and Trey. They were always like, you know, God, you guys were screwed. And I was like, I guess so. But, you know, those guys did years of South Park before they really were able to make a movie that was going to get a wide release that was within their voice. And that it makes more sense to me. You know, if we'd have done The Idiot Box for 5 to 10 years, then we could have made – they would have been like, oh, it's The Idiot Box, guys. We're going to give this a wide release, like Jackass or something.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the people that were involved with Freaked. Just starting from, you know, the first minutes of the film with that great opening credit sequence. That was done by David Daniels, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
He's amazing. I kind of looked some stuff up on him, and the animation style that he does, that's totally insane. And he did the opening sequence for The Idiot Box as well, didn't he?
Correct, yes. We had, I think, I could be totally wrong, but I think the reason we connected with Dave Daniels, we'd done some stuff for a company called Broadcast Arts that did the Pee-wee's Playhouse stuff, and I think we sort of found each other through that. We were huge fans of Strata-Cut, which is the name of that style of claymation that he invented, and we really wanted to use it in something, and The Idiot Box was an opportunity, and you know, he did that for no money and, you know, for very little money. He got paid, but it was very little, and we were so blown away by it, and you know, it was a no-brainer to use him on Freaked. I mean, it wasn't an immediate, easy get. We had to sell it to the studio, and we went around the houses, as you do with all this stuff. But But his work is absolutely amazing. And when you lock that work with – I mean, the one thing with Freak that I love is in terms of Dave, is the marriage of him with the Blind Idiot God, Henry Rollins track, is so perfect. And yeah. They complement each other so well. You know, that was in a way – it's the great thing about cult movies, which it undoubtedly is because it had such a small release, is that – that was our death knell in a way. I mean, once you show, you know, Dave and Blind Idiot God to a studio panel, right. I mean, talk about all your cards on the table. It's like yeah. a big giant dump being plopped in their lap. You know?
Yeah.
And what are they going to do with that? You know, we just did not fuck around. We were like, okay, what the hell? It's an Idiot Box movie. Let's go. And in hindsight, I'm just so glad that we did. I mean, that movie with any compromise would have been unwatchable. So I love Dave's work with the Blind Idiot God track and the Rollins track. I think it works great together.
Yeah, and that song, it was written for the movie, correct?
Oh yeah. Andy Hawkins is one of my oldest and best friends. The lead of Blind Idiot God. We were been best friends since we were six, literally since we were 6 years old. And I've done a lot of stuff with B.I.G. over the years. You know, I've shot record covers for them. I mean, we've just been like a little collective. And Andy's records are being produced by Bill Laswell. So Bill and I became friends, and that's how we ended up getting P-Funk on the record, and all that other stuff sort of came via the Andy Hawkins, Bill Laswell axis.
Yeah, and you were also good friends with the Butthole Surfers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of the chronology of this movie, and again, just dispose of whatever refuse you don't need. Right. You know, we'd originally written this movie. I don't remember whether Sam was going to do this one or not. It was in the same time we were working with Raimi. But we wrote the movie originally to be done as a $200,000 Buttholes vehicle with Gibby. Like, right. We flew him up to L.A. and he stayed in our apartment, which was like this little Venice shithole. And we wrote this movie together. And it was this really irreverent – I'm trying to find a copy of the script, because like a PDF, because it should be out there. It was so – retardedly over the top. It was like Evil Dead 2 meets a Butthole Show, basically. And and it was just carnage, and we couldn't sell it, you know, unsurprisingly. nobody wanted to buy it. And it was going to be Entering Texas, you know, as a feature. I mean, that's basically what it was. And Entering Texas was basically an abbreviation of our Freak idea. Mm-hmm. You know, it's essentially what it was. I don't know if you ever saw Entering Texas, but it was a short we made with the Buttholes. And it's a family is like on a vacation in Texas, and they pick up a hitchhiker, and they get taken to the Buttholes compound, and they all get killed. And and it's great. It's one of my favorite things that Tom and I ever did. And we shot it for $1.50 with the Buttholes in Austin, and John Hawks, who's a very celebrated actor, is in Winter's Bone right now, and was in the Idiot Box, and he played Cowboy and Freak. He's the dad, and it's Gibby and all the guys. And we basically – that was essentially like a Freaked dry run. So, you know, it's I'm very happy that it ended up being what it was. And we threw the Buttholes are in there. The music is in there. But I don't think anybody would have seen the movie that we were writing, frankly.
Yeah.
And at least four people got to see Freaked, you know?
Right.
In terms of casting, like, did you like do a lot of auditioning for people that you wanted to be in the movie, or did you just kind of know through associations and friendships who you wanted to get in?
It was a combination. I mean, we had sort of, you know, Tom and I basically created for ourselves a troupe that was in all of our stuff. That was, you know, a combination of actors that I'd worked with in movies that I was acting in, and actors from the Actors Gang who I was very close with. Basically, you know, what we consider to be the best actors in LA at the time that were into the kind of stuff we were into, you know, because Kenneth Branagh was not interested in playing the Human Torch. But, but you know, so we had this troupe of like, you know, John Hawks, Lee Ehrenberg, Brian Brophy, a lot of these guys, you know, have gone on to do great stuff. And those were no brainers. You know, I knew I was going to play Rick. We knew that John was going to play Cowboy. We knew Lee was going to play the Torch. We had a bunch of people. Most of the Freaks are from the Actors Gang. That whole gang of them are in it. And then John Kahn and the rest of them. And then we auditioned the parts that we didn't know. And we held these absolutely. I think a lot of those are, I don't know if some of them ended up on the Anchor Bay DVD, but we have unrelentingly hilarious HD or it was high eight back then tapes of the auditions, because people would come in dressed as freaks and it was just bananas. But and then finding, you know, then getting Randy. We went out to a lot of people for Elijah before we found Randy, and that was just one of those amazing strokes of luck because he was so unbelievably great.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where we finally, because he's really a method guy, and like it took us a long time for us to figure out his wardrobe and for him to be happy with it. And like I remember the day we were up at his house and we like got it all dialed together and we all looked at each other and we were like, holy shit, this is going to be unbelievable, you know?
Yeah.
It was just the whole package. And before then, we were out to – we'd gone out to Oliver Reed, who we really wanted.
Yeah.
But the studio wouldn't let us use him because he has a writer in his contract well, he had a writer in his contract demanding that he could drink whenever he wanted. Which is partly why we wanted him.
Right,
know?
Yeah, but, that seems apropos for the part.
Yeah. But that wasn't going to fly at 20th Century Fox, so we couldn't use Ollie Reed. And then I think the next person we went after was George C. Scott. You could see where our heads were at, right?
Right, yeah.
And George C. Scott, for some reason, was uninsurable. And I don't remember what – he wasn't an alcoholic. I don't know what the deal was, but they wouldn't work with George C. Scott. I guess he pitched – you know, he probably said something nasty about a studio chairman at one point. He's he was a, you know, a fairly obstreperous fellow.
Mm-hmm.
So we found Randy. You know, Randy took to the script. We begged him and pleaded with him to do it, and he was awesome. So, you know, that was the key audition not audition, because he didn't audition, but that was the key sort of casting component that we had to go out and find.
Yeah.
The rest of the gang was fairly plug and play from all of the work we were doing already.
Right.
Same with a lot of the crew. And, you know, interestingly, Catherine Hardwick, we had an amazing crew. You know, we had PDI doing our CGI, who went on to do Shrek. We had Catherine Hardwick was our production designer, who went on to direct Twilight and everything else. And we had Screaming Mad George doing designs. It was Bill Corso did my makeup, who's won a bunch of Oscars. It was really a phenomenal team, and everybody knew they had lucked into some weird, crazy, special movie that just shouldn't be happening. That why did they give these two 25-year-old kids $12 million? And so everyone just had it. We really got 150% out of everybody, and it was an amazing experience for that reason.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the design a little bit, because that's one of the things that I think really sets this movie apart, and one of the reasons why I think I and a lot of people have really latched on to it. I really love the design of the freaks, you know, especially you know, the Beast Boy, and you know, that reminds me of like Basil Wolverton or like Big Daddy Ed Roth kind of thing gone crazy. And who was responsible for the initial design? Did you guys sketch that out initially and then kind of hand it over to Scream Mad George and the gang and let them do their thing? Or
yeah, I mean, the way that Tom and I worked, and certainly the way I work is, you know, because I do a lot of effects-driven work, and, you know, sometimes you come at these movies more like it's an animation, you know? So Tom and I built the visual look of this movie as we were, even before we pitched it. Like, we knew, you know, the names you're mentioning were names that we were specifically wanted to visually reference. We wanted the creatures to be Basil Wolverton creatures. We wanted a Mad Magazine element.
Yeah.
We knew stylistically that we wanted to marry Mad Magazine, Zap Comics, and essentially, you know, a modern, edgy, Raimi-esque type of pulp movie.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew that going in, you know, but with a Mel Brooks tonality.
Yeah.
And that's what the movie is. I mean, that is what we're trying to do. And was sort of taking, you know, what if you took Blazing Saddles and, you know, you cranked it through a Mad Magazine machine, you know? And that's kind of what it is. And, you know, because that's the stuff that we like, you know, in terms of we like a lot of different kinds of stuff. But in terms of comedy, that's the type of stuff that I really like and Tom really likes. So, you know, we went to George, we went to everybody with a very, very, very specific vision, mm-hmm. you know, with a specific color palette, with specific ideas for how things should look. But we also went to these artists because we knew they were going to go off. So, you know, it wasn't like Jim Cameron, only because I can't draw as well as Jim Cameron, but it wasn't like handing George an illustration and just saying, make that. I mean, he went and came up with great ideas. Bill Corso came up with great ideas. You know, Steve Johnson, Tony Gardner, who I've worked with on two movies since then, everybody went off and came up with great stuff. And all of it made it into the movie. You know, it was an army of talent. It was really an amazing set to be on. You know, on any given day, it would be us and George and Tony and Steve Johnson and Bill Corso and Catherine, and just this insane brain trust of creativity.
Yeah. And did you guys, when you were doing it, when you initially saw the makeup, did you know right away that that's what you wanted? Did they nail it right off the bat, or did you have to go through some evolution and some changes?
It went through evolutions. It's funny. I just recently unearthed some of the storage boxes I have that have George's initial designs on them.
Yeah.
And it's really different where it ended up. But, you know, but he also went through a lot of iterations. So, you know, some of his initial designs were a little too literal.
Right.
You know, like the dog boy was literally a dog.
Yeah.
You know, too much like a dog. And I was a little too like ha-ha comedy face guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was trying to read. That's not where George would naturally go. So we took the brakes off and we're like, no, we want you to do what you do. We want something that's more phantasmagoric. We want more of a nightmare. Don't think that because we're comedy guys that we want this to be light. And that's what he really went off and ran with. And that was the same for like the Stewie and Rick monster and all that stuff. The you know, what we would generally say was take where we're going and then push it another 50-75% over the edge.
Yeah.
Were there any like freaks that you wanted to put in upon the initial writing that you just couldn't do with effects, or you didn't have the money to do, and that you had to scrap, or anything like that?
There were certain things that my character, if I'm remembering correctly, that I was going to do that I couldn't do. But I will say that we steadfastly refused to be told no. We used to get into horrendous fights with production design and makeup on what we could and couldn't accomplish, and we just drove them until they did it. And you know, the complexity of my makeup, for instance, which, you know, had like three or four different servo engines in it in order to articulate eyes, lips, mouth, cheek. It was really freaking complicated. And, you know, that we got a lot of pushback, you know, it can't be done. We were just like, just do it. Let's just keep figuring it out. Let's solve the problem. And we had enough money for the production, and we were savvy enough with how we spent the money that we spent a year just in R&D. The one hilarious thing was Catherine Hardwicke and we had this long running feud over whether the worm would ever walk. They were all like, you can't have a human worm because you guys can't afford to create this thing that's going to actually move in a shot. It's always going to just be stuck there, you know, like some kind of horrible thing from the original Dr. Doolittle, you know.
Yeah.
And we're like, no, we'll figure it out. And we have one great high shot where you see him walking away from Rick as he tries to convince him to join the ranks. And again, it was just brain trust, you know. We were adamant, and that goes a long way, you know.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the makeup, I mean, I gotta imagine wearing the effect when you were half, you know, human, half freak. That had to have been a crazy experience. Were you ever at any point just thinking to yourself, "What the hell have I done to myself, and what have I got myself into?"
No, I wasn't. I've done a lot of prosthetics work. You know, I'd done the grandmother in Bill and Ted before that, which Yeager did, and I'd done a lot of prosthetics work. I did a lot of prosthetic work with Lost Boys. I'd done, and by the time I got to Freaked, I'd done worse. You know, I got my eyes scratched in Lost Boys because those little bastards, the Coreys, kicked a bunch of dirt in my face in my death scene. I had to go to the hospital. Yeah. And I mean, not to speak ill of the dead. Actually, it was Feldman anyway, the little shit. But and then, like in film school, we had made this movie called Isles of Doom, where I played this like evil cretinous owner of a five and dime that tortures the kids that come in. And we had no money. We wanted full prosthetics, and we found like a college student makeup artist who's now like the main makeup artist for the Metropolitan Opera. He's really, really good. In fact, Rob did all my prosthetics and effects work on Fever. He's really, really good. But back then he was a freshman at NYU. He didn't know what the hell he was doing. And I was a guinea pig and I needed a full head prosthetic with no money. So his solution was to pour hot gelatin on my head and let it set.
Yeah.
Now for gelatin to be hot enough to pour on your head pre-molding, it has to be like having fucking tea poured on your head.
Yeah.
So every day for like a month and a half when I was shooting this student film, I was like at 5 a.m. getting this prosthetic put on my head, which basically meant having hot gelatin poured all over my head until it set.
Right.
So by the time I got to Freaked, you know, and I'm working with Bill Corso, who is arguably the greatest makeup artist alive right now. You know, he's did Lemony Snicket's. He's done everything.
It was
bliss. I mean, I didn't feel it coming on. I didn't feel it coming off. And that's why I started sleeping in it, because I wasn't getting any sleep because I was directing and I was spending so much time in the chair after shoot and so much time in the chair in the morning. It was like 7 hours of just makeup on and off on top of my shoot day, which was like 12 hours. So I just said to Bill eventually, can I just sleep in this? He said, yeah, for like 3 to 5 days, you'll probably get away with it. So that's what I started doing.
Really? So you were like driving home in the makeup and everything?
I was driving home in the makeup, man. I was causing accidents.
I was going to say, yeah, I'm sure there's people with various stories seeing that on the highway.
Yeah, it was a trip. But no, it really wasn't that bad. I mean, my skin went into shock after the movie was done.
Yeah.
But, you know, psychologically it wasn't – I mean, I can't say it was arduous. The person who had, funnily enough, the most arduous makeup was Reeves.
Really?
The dog, we were just really particular about how we made everything look. And you know, Tony Gardner, who designed and implemented Dog Boy, you know, we had done tests on like just prosthetic layering and they didn't work. They just looked terrible and there was no facial articulation. So the only solution we could come up with was to literally glue the hair onto his face.
Oh, yeah.
So every freaking morning for like 4 hours, he would sit and we shot in the summertime in LA, you know, it was like 100 degrees, and he would sit there in like a meditative state and have hair individually glued to his face, like thousands of them.
Oh man.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Was there much of a struggle? I know when the movie first came out, Keanu Reeves was uncredited. Was there sort of a struggle with that? Did you want him to be credited, or was it not a big deal to you that?
No, it was a bummer. I mean, you know, it's not one – you know, he's a really close friend of mine. It had absolutely nothing to do with him. It was more like, you know, deals that were being made and agents and I don't – you know, I hate to say I don't remember the exact reason because I didn't produce the movie, so I didn't deal with his money end at all. And I have a feeling it had to do with money. I'm sure it did. I don't know that for sure, so I hate to say it and, like, piss off whoever his agent was in you know – 1905 when we made it, but
and I'm sure they're listening to our podcast.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah, you'll get a cease and desist from, you know, the Schenkman and Glassbaum agency in Cincinnati. But I don't know what the reason was. You know, it might have been financial. It might have been if you get him uncredited, it's X, and if you get him credited, it's Y, and we couldn't afford Y. But I'm talking out of my butt because I honestly don't remember. And it was really funny because one day it was just about to come out on DVD in London. And it came out on DVD in London before the States, and I was working in London, and I was working very closely with Fox UK on the release. And they were like, you know, it'd really be great if you could put Reeves on the movie. He always goes out and talks about it. It's not like he doesn't, you know, he doesn't love the movie. And I was like, yeah, you know, I don't even remember why he's not credited. And, you know, we were hanging out in London together as it happened. We were like going to a museum or like going to the theater or something. And I was like, you know, the DVD's coming out. Do you care if you're on the credits? He's like, you mean I'm not? And so that's when he started being on the credit. But that's how lame the industry can be sometimes.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about working with Mr. T. First, I'd like to know if he was – I mean, if that was the original idea to have him come in as the bearded lady or if he was one of the ones that you guys just kind of casted afterwards, because I think that's, you know, a stroke of casting brilliance. And, I always thought that was hilarious. Was that something that was like kind of an afterthought when you started casting, or was that something – someone you originally wanted? And then once he was on the set, from the commentary and everything, I had deduced that it was somewhat of a adventure working with him.
It wasn't an afterthought. You know, when we wrote the movie, we were like, it struck us that he would be the ultimate bearded lady.
Yeah, absolutely.
And from then on, we had to have Mr. T as the bearded lady. And we had to go find him. I don't know if this is on the commentary. We found him. He was doing pantomime in London, in England somewhere. Like, he was doing Aladdin in, like, northern England.
Yeah.
And he was awesome. And I got to say, for all of the sort of, you know, the busting on him that we've done in you know, the years since because of the ignominious way in which he departed our set,
right,
which has been oft discussed, he was awesome. I mean, he was, you know, for 99 point, and frankly, for the entire shoot, he was awesome. He just disappeared at one point.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like he became difficult and then disappeared. He was great. Everyone loved him. Everyone worshipped the ground he walked on. He was the absolute center of the set every day. He would just sit in his director's chair and everybody just circled around him and listened to stories. And so, he, you know, he was treated with a great deal of totally sincere respect. It just, it was definitely a taking your piss out of yourself type of role. And I think it just eventually it just got to him, you know, I just think that's what, but he was great and he was great to work with. And it wasn't like he was a diva, cause he wasn't at all. He's this really sweet, smart, cool guy. But I just think he got a little fried on the whole notion of what he was doing with his image.
Sure. So in terms of the release of the film, you know, there was a kind
that's
of
a very friendly way of putting it, but yeah.
there was kind of a changing of the guard at 20th Century Fox, and the exec that came in, I guess, wasn't a huge fan of the film, and that's why, like, the title got changed from Hideous Mutant Freaks to Freaked, and there were the post-production budget was cut, and the release was stifled significantly.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that a movie like this needs one person shepherding it all the way through. And to be honest, that's rarely going to happen at a film studio, because there's, you know, there aren't that many chairmen that have been there that long. And ours wasn't there long enough to shepherd it through. I mean, there's really no other way of putting it. It wasn't so much like the guys that came in were these sort of evil villains that staunchly said, we're going to screw your movie. Now, I'm not even sure how much we're on their radar, to be honest with you. We're just another movie on the previous slate, and they looked at it, and it made no sense to them whatsoever, which it wouldn't to nine-tenths of people in Hollywood. I mean, probably to nine-tenths of people in Hollywood still, they wouldn't know what the hell to do with a movie like that. They're off making fucking Norbert, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not that bizarre. You know, it was an irreverent movie that was ahead of its time. It was definitely – I mean, it was made for not that much money. I don't think it would have actually hurt anybody, but it was just a head-scratcher, you know? And I don't think that looking back on it, we're just damn lucky that we were through the bulk of post when that happened, because, you know, all I care about is that we made the damn movie. It's like, you know, it was the hardest thing about it was not being able to make a soundtrack, because we had Iggy Pop, because we had Motorhead, because we had the Red Hot Chili Peppers, because we had everybody great writing songs for us, and we never got to make the record. That was a bummer.
Yeah, you know? That would have been great.
That would have been, you know, we snuck P-Funk in because Laswell's really sneaky, and he just always sees stuff going wrong. So he just made sure we got P-Funk. And that was the only time P-Funk had ever recorded together, with Bootsy and George and everybody actually united. And we're really lucky we got that track laid down. We're really lucky we got Blondie to God and Henry. And then we just pulled resources with the Buttholes and everybody else. But, you know, that's a drag. And then, you know, sure, not getting a wider release is a drag, because it definitely did put the brakes on other plans that Tom and I had, for sure. Because the notion of us getting bankrolled again and right after that were non-existent.
Yeah.
And that's just a fact. I mean, it's not the end of the world. We're both coming to the end of a very long run, which we kind of knew while we were making Freak, to be totally honest with you. We've been working together for 9 years and we were ready to move on. But I wonder what would have come had we had an opportunity to do more. And that's not to say we won't do more, because I think we will do more together down the road. We're hatching some ideas now, and I wouldn't rule out the notion that we would do some more stuff together down the road.
Yeah, excellent.
Including possibly an Idiot Box reunion, which we've been toying with for a while, and now we're beginning to get a bit more serious with.
Really? Would it be for MTV, or would it be for another outlet?
Possibly. It's really early, but we're exploring all options.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, that would be really cool. So I wanted to ask, you know, after the film's kind of disappointing release, were you surprised, you know, later at the kind of cult following that it had? I remember at the very advent of the internet, I would see fan sites dedicated to Freaked, and it seemed like everybody that I knew loved it, because, you know, we had seen it on HBO and you know, rented it from the video store, and, you know, for a lot of the reasons you mentioned before, the whole Mad Magazine, Mel Brooks sensibilities, I mean, that was exactly what we were looking for, and I think it spoke to us on all those levels as, you know, teenage kids, and I think that's why we all gravitated towards this. But were you surprised when, you know, it did get that cult following? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess it was kind of destined for that, but are you surprised that people would come up to you and say, you know, I love, that's my favorite movie or anything like that?
Well, you know, look, for people, I get a lot of, we have a really big fan base for Freak and The Idiot Box, and I'm really, really happy about that. I mean, people ask me the same question about Bill and Ted and Lost Boys, frankly, and the answer is no to all. I mean, nobody, you never assume that your movie is, you know what I mean? You just don't. Yeah. You know, why would you? I mean, what kind of a-hole would? Like, I'd love to see, you know, we all hope that it does, but when it happens, it's really not something that you've even been able to conceptualize, you know? And because you don't, I mean, I remember reading an interview with Chris Nolan recently after Inception came out, where he was talking about Batman, and it's like, you know, he was saying very humbly, and it didn't feel like false modesty, that just like, you know, how could he have expected Dark Knight to do those kind of numbers? You know, nobody controls the zeitgeist. Nobody.
Yeah.
The movie studios don't. Steven Spielberg doesn't. Nobody does. If they did, they would make nothing but hits movie after movie after movie, which, of course, nobody does. So,
sure.
You know, to be accepted into the zeitgeist and to stay there, or to have those projects stay there, yeah, I mean, I'm insanely grateful for that. And I wouldn't say I'm, like, staggeringly shocked, because, you know, with Freaked specifically, that was such a team effort. I mean, it was such an effort. It was like, you know, Bill and Ted had done well, so the studios were interested in talking to us, and I was going to be in it. Keanu was going to have a part, and then the kids loved The Idiot Box, and it was like all these things lined up, and then, you know, we had all these artists that came on board, and we got Catherine to production design, and we got, you know, Corso to do the makeup, and it was like, in a way, I get it, because we had such an amazing talent pool, and I think we had a really solid script, as crazy as it was.
Yeah.
But I'm really grateful, because you do, you know, you try to do that on every movie, and every movie does not connect by any means, you know? So, you know, yes, it's something I'm really grateful for, and you know, it's why I have absolutely no regrets about even what happens. Like, you know, people ask me about the whole studio shuffle. I'm like, how do you regret that? I made a freaking movie and people like it, and I'm really jazzed. And that's kind of as far as it goes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess basically what I was saying, because it did seem like it was very hard, especially in the 90s, to get this movie. I mean, it played on HBO every now and again. I remember trying to buy the videotape, actually, and it wasn't even available for sale. You had to buy like a rental copy, which was like $40, which I actually, you know, shelled out the money for, because I wanted to have it so much. And so, you know, it's one of those ones that is like kind of against all odds, and, you know, that not being easily accessible, people really gravitated towards it. I mean, I still mention this movie all the time to people that I feel have the same kind of sensibilities about movies and stuff. And I almost without fail, everybody says, yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. I watched it all the time as a kid. And I think it's just surprising for me, for a movie that wasn't very accessible. You know, there's tons of movies that were on TV and in theaters all the time, you know, a thousand times more than Freak, that have kind of faded out of, you know, the consciousness of, you know, nerds like us, but this one has really endured, and I think that's just a testament to how strong the movie is, even against the obstacles of, you know, the release and everything. It still shine through.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I really do, and I think that you know, to be fair to Fox, you know, because I've learned a lot. I was 25, you know, and I'd worked for the studios as an actor and actually had great experiences with them. I'd done two Bill and Ted movies by then, and had a great relationship with everyone at the studios that I was working with, and had a huge I mean, we weren't like anarchists, you know, but to be fair to them, you know, the movie's audience, like, I remember when we first showed the movie to Joe Roth before he left Fox and went over to Disney, which is what happened. We showed the movie to him. He loved the movie. He was very involved the whole way through. And I remember the very first screening when we showed it to him, and he was like, this movie has got an audience, and now we have to go and find it. And he was absolutely 100% right. Now, had he stayed, he would have found the audience, and it would have been on a more conventionally respectable level than what we ended up doing, which is basically hustling the movie on our own, which is what we did. We had like three posters made, and we hustled it from festival to festival and art house to art house. And then it got enough of a buzz and good reviews that it got picked up for cable and all of the repertory houses. But, you know, the bottom line is, at the end of the day, we found our audience. You know, we didn't find it the way we thought we were going to. I don't think that movie ever would have made anyone rich. I really don't. I don't think it's a grand slam movie for the Midwest mainstream market. It just isn't. So I think we found our audience. We made a big ass $12 million cult movie, and it found its audience. And at the end of the day, that's great.
Absolutely.
I just had a couple more questions about the casting and stuff. I was wondering how, because I have a huge crush on her, how Megan Ward got involved with the movie.
It's funny. We did a screening of the movie at New Beverly Cinema, which is one of the best movie theaters in L.A., about 6 months ago. And she surprised us because Tom and I went and did a Q&A, and she surprised us and came out for the screening, which was so awesome. I haven't seen her since we made the movie. She looked fantastic. And she's very sane and got out of the movie industry. We just auditioned her, you know? Auditioned her. So, I mean, it was really as simple as that. We went out to cast. I mean, we didn't know her, from our gang, you know? We didn't know Michael Stoyanov from our gang. We're people that we auditioned. So she was awesome. And, you know, she and Michael went through hell. I mean, that was a really tough makeup rig to wear.
Yeah.
So it was, it was tough. It was a tough shoot for everybody. But it was a fun shoot. I mean, it wasn't, it wasn't making the abyss. We weren't like in a water tanker in Mexico, for 9 months. It was really fun. We were shooting locally and everybody, it was a ridiculously laugh filled set, but it was hard. Yeah. And Megan had a lot of tough stuff to do.
Indeed. Looking back on the movie, like, is there anything that you would have changed or anything you would have liked to have had in or anything like that?
We've got the deleted scenes on the DVD. The scene that I, from a narrative standpoint, that I really feel we should not have cut was the farewell to the freak scene. I think the movie plays is okay without it, but I think that scene is kind of an important narrative moment. I'm glad it's on the DVD outtakes. I believe it is. I think it's that one and the Wheel of Fortune scene that are on there. But otherwise, no. And I don't, at the end of the world, that didn't ruin the movie. So not really. I mean, I think that there's always stuff that you would do different. I mean, we were so young, we made it. We made a million mistakes, there's always things you would do differently, but every movie is about making mistakes. I mean, that's what makes every movie fun and its own animal, if it's a real movie and not just fodder. But no, I wouldn't say, I don't really think so. Other than that scene, I'm pretty happy with it all the way around. It is what it is, and I think that it works on the level that it needs to work. There's certain things that worked better than I thought they would, to be honest with you. There's stuff like the whole Stewie as a phantom troll thing. It was one of those things, and when we were writing, it was like, God, I hope this works. Like certain things I knew were freaking hilarious, like the hammer gag, the hammer flashback for me. I mean, I didn't know that in the theater. That's my favorite thing ever in anything I've ever done is the hammer flashback.
That's funny that you say that.
Or in a nutshell. And that was the kind of thing you write it and you're like, I really don't give a shit if no one finds this funny because I think this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. But the Stewie troll thing I wasn't so sure about. I kind of credit John Hawks, the scene with him as cowboy, for selling that. The let him into your heart speech that he
did. Yeah.
And I know it's ridiculous to talk about this movie on narrative terms, but you did ask. So so that was one that I was happy. There were certain plot things that we were trying that were pretty far out that I was happy that they worked as well as they did. And then some things, I don't want to go into detail about negatives. Some things didn't work quite as well. There's certain things that didn't work as well as I wish they would have. There's a few things from a writing standpoint that aren't quite as good as they should have been. But I don't know how many people have noticed it, to be honest with you.
It's funny that you bring up that hammer gag, because before we started recording this, I was telling Kevin about how I was going to have to tell you that that's like my favorite part of the movie, how much I love that joke.
Oh, great. Awesome. Yes, then whatever gene that got mutated, we have the same one. And that was the very first thing we shot. The very first day of shooting was Randy going to the hardware store to get the hammer. And very satisfying way to start your first movie. Having Randy Quaid, one of our favorite actors in the world, performing one of the oddest, potentially most obtuse jokes in the history of movie jokes.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure he understood it. He's like, I don't understand what the fuck you guys are doing. Let it, the kids like it. Right.
So, after Freaked, you kind of took a break from the film industry for a while. Was that something that you wanted to do, or was it just by virtue of after the kind of release debacle and everything?
It wasn't after the release debacle, because I had a really thriving acting career at that point. But sure. What really happened was that Tom and I really wanted to start working on our own stuff, and I just needed to go away and just focus on my own voice. And I also had spent so much time after film school acting and not anywhere near the amount of time writing and shooting that I wanted to.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a balance that I was feeling very – I was just frankly wasn't that happy. I felt like, you know, if I'm not going to just get to shoot another movie, which isn't going to happen right this second because of what happened with Freak for sure. Not that we really have one in the hopper, because we really were kind of going, all right, let's do something else. But I just knew I wanted to shoot. And so I just wanted to focus on writing and shooting and just not worry about teeing up something. And that's what I did. I mean, I just, you know, I went to London and formed the production company in the UK and very happily shot, you know, some of my favorite things I've ever done. I mean, British advertising is unparalleled. And I got to do some great, great work. And I did nothing but write and shoot for like three or four years. And then I wrote Fever, put that together and made that.
Yeah.
You know? And was really, really happy. I knew I wanted to do something low budget. I knew I wanted to do something artistic. I knew I wanted to do something that wasn't going to injure anybody financially.
Right.
And I knew I wanted to just tell a story absolutely my way from the heart that was not going to be encumbered by any corporate bullshit. And yeah. It was incredibly satisfying. And I was really happy with the result and really happy with the reviews. And, you know, we got lauded in Cannes and all over the place. It was great. You know, but then it was time to come back and do stuff on a more mainstream level, and that's what I set my sights on after Fever, frankly.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And right now, okay. You're working on The Gate, right?
Yep. I show is.
How's that going?
I've been for about 2 years, actually. We've been working on 3D tests and creature design and storyboarding and script development for about 2 years, and we're just about to start pre-production in the official sense of the word, which means we begin our set builds and – we've already been casting, but we begin like the hard stuff, as it were. So,
That a film that you were a fan of originally? Is that what drew you?
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah. It's you know, it was a little after my time, you know, but
sure.
What I loved about it was twofold. One is what Randy Cook did with the Minions was famous in effect circles. Everyone knew about The Gate. Because everyone knew about the foreground miniatures and everyone knew about the stop motion. In fact, we used Dave Allen, who did the Minion animation on The Gate. Dave Allen did the Gumby. Oh no, he didn't. That was the Kyoto brothers. What did Dave do? Dave did some stop motion on Freak. Oh, he did when the EES shoe when they all get glopped and they turn into the giant shoe. That
right.
was Dave Allen, who's one of the most famous stop motion guys in the world, and he worked on The Gate. So I certainly knew of it. But I always had a love for dream. I mean, Fever is a dream movie. Freaked is arguably a dream movie. You don't, you know, from the moment that Rick hits Santa Flan, you just don't know whether you're even in reality or not anymore.
Right.
And Fever is definitely a dream movie. It's you don't know exactly whether you're watching reality or not. And it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. And I'm always drawn to those kinds of stories. And that's what The Gate was, you know, on an accessible mainstream level. It's this weird world where there's no adults around and the kids are faced with this incredibly strange challenge, and it's very surreal and very phantasmagoric. And I love that about it.
Yeah.
And that's really up my alley for a directing project. And that's really what I've changed the script quite a bit. I'm developing it. I'm modernizing it, but you know, it will have that kind of effect, and it will also have humor and you know, be raucous and a lot of fun action and stuff as well. But it almost harkens back more to like those Amblin movies like Poltergeist or The Goonies. I mean, I'd say, I guess, more Poltergeist than The Goonies, but we're not quite as horrific as Poltergeist.
Yeah.
You know, where the movies were kind of dreamlike and stakes were high and the protagonists were young and, you know, that's what it is, you know?
Yeah, sounds great.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I mean, it's not a money gig. It's a project that I really care about, and it's I think it has a chance. You know, if we don't fuck it up, it has a chance to be a really fantastic movie.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, are you finding it hard to work in 3D?
No, I'm not. I mean, I'm really technical. You know, I've been working in effects since they started. You know, since CG started anyway, and I know a lot about this world. I do a lot of effects-driven commercials. I did in London, and I'm not intimidated by that process at all. And I have done a lot of research. I'm not intimidated by it at all. I think it's going to look absolutely fantastic. You just have to design for it. It's really that simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you start, you know, we've been storyboarding for 3D since before the script was done, you know, and we've been writing for 3D, and we have an amazing visual effects supervisor, and we have an amazing producer who's been working in IMAX 3D since it began. And, you know, we're doing a mix of stereo and conversion, but we're not doing any crappy retrofitting. You know, it's going to look nice. So I'm excited about it.
Excellent. Now, there's also rumors that you've been chosen to write a screenplay for a Rock and Roll High School remake. Is there any validity to that?
Yeah, I wrote it. I mean, I'd love to say I was more involved in, you know, I could make a play to take it back and try to make it, but it honestly was an assignment. I mean, I went after it because I loved the original, thought it was ripe for a remake.
Yeah.
But it's not in my hands what the company that I wrote it for does with it. So the short answer is yes, I wrote it, and I have no idea what will come of it.
Really?
No, I mean, it's you know, it was, for all intents and purposes, an assignment, meaning they pay mm-hmm. me to write it, they own it, they do whatever they want with it. And Howard owns that movie, and he owns Porky's. And he's owned both of those titles for a long time, and neither of those have been made yet. So I don't know whether they'll ever make either.
Yeah. Now, was the assignment basically to update it, or did you do a lot of, you know, your own touches to it, or?
No, I didn't. There was no assignment in terms of the creative. I went and pitched them a creative take, and they liked it. So yeah. I had a very specific vision for what to do with it, and they bought that vision. So that's what I wrote. They didn't muck around with that so much. It was just, I don't own it. You know, it's for another company.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they're going to do with it. And what I wrote was very much, you know, my whole pitch to them was that I think it would be sacrosanct. You know, the original movie is sacrosanct, and it would be sacrilegious to try to find the Ramones in 2010.
Absolutely.
Because they don't exist. And right. Because music does not have the same cultural rebellion that it used to have. It's more corporate. It's safer. There's rebellion in the youth movement, and it doesn't normally happen through music so much, not on that level. It happens in other areas, mostly in technology, which is why I've been working on the Napster story for so long.
Yeah.
But that's a true youth revolt. But you know, my pitch to them was, don't try to replicate the Ramones. Don't, like, get Green Day to be the band in the high. It just won't work. And
yeah.
No one will. So we came at it from a completely different angle. But I maintained the Corman-esque, you know, rowdiness. It's a Corman-esque movie that I wrote. It's just not a Ramones movie, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, hopefully something will get done with that. Because, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the original and a huge fan of yours. So I would love to see.
Yeah, it'd be fun. I liked it. You just don't know. And I mean, you know, I don't lose sleep over it. It was a lot of fun to write, and I liked everyone I worked with. I just don't know what they'll do with it, you know.
Yeah. So after The Gate, do you have anything on your plate, or is that pretty much just...
Well, I'm really busy with that because it's an effects-driven project. So I'm going to be on it a while. Yeah, I have another couple of movies that I'm developing. I have a couple of TV shows that I'm developing, comedies. And which I would talk about if they were further along, but it's kind of like, you know, I don't really talk about them until they're further along. And we are, yeah, you know, we're talking about possibly doing an Idiot Box revival, which would be more sort of ancillary for both of us. We would sort of, you know, put it together and go knock it out for fun.
Yeah.
And do it in the digital space probably. You know, and then I wrote the Napster movie, and I would very much like to make that at some point. I might attempt to bring that, into being after The Gate. Because it's fairly easy to shoot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a great story. It's about music and technology, and it's really a story that nobody is. There's nothing like it. So, be fun to do.
Yeah, okay. It seems like there's more of a story with Napster than there is for Facebook, and that's got a movie coming out. So.
Yeah, I think that you know, Facebook is an easier sell because, you know, it's an immediate in your face brand. And people can go, we're going to make a Facebook movie, and everyone's got Facebook. So it's like, great, let's make a Facebook movie. And you know, and once you get, you know, you know, once you have that talent attached, you know, once you have David Fincher directing it, you know, and you've got Aaron Sorkin writing it, you got a great, it's going to be a great movie. So I'm happy that they made it because I actually think it will be a great movie. That being said, the Napster story in terms of, the scope of a world-changing youth revolt that's not the Facebook story. So, and I don't think there's much crossover there. I think that, you know, my story is a music is about the music industry, and it involves real bands, and it would have real bands in it, and it would really be about what I consider to be the biggest youth revolt since the 60s. And that's what the movie's about.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, you know, Social Network might keep us from ever getting made, but I don't know. I mean, we would be a little movie. I want to make a little indie music movie, you know? I wouldn't want to be like, we're another big kids going up against the technological beast movie. I mean, they're doing that already. We don't need to do that.
Yeah.
But is there anything else that's burning that that you wanted to ask?
No, we just wanted to, you know, thank you for taking some time and talking with us. You know, I just really wanted to let you know that we're huge fans of the movie. I think it was extremely ahead of its time. You know, you see a lot of stuff like Family Guy and South Park using that same style of humor. And I think that was really, you know, a huge, you know, comedy turning point for me as a kid, seeing that movie and really latching onto that. So I just want to thank you for that movie. And it's something that's brought us together. I think that was when we first started this podcast, it was one of the first movies we talked about, like what kind of movies did we want to talk about? And I think the word freaked came out of all of our mouths at the same time. And so we're all huge fans, and we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. It was really cool.
No sweat. And shoot me an email when you've got this thing up. I'll have a listen.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Well, thanks again. And good luck. And we look forward to everything that you got coming up.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys.
Yep. Take care.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that just about wraps up Junk Food Dinner episode 22. I'd like to thank Mr. Alex Winter for taking some time out and talking with us. That was a huge treat for us, and we really appreciate him taking time out of his busy schedule to sit down and talk with us, and we hope you guys enjoyed that. So, like we said on last episode, stick around. Next week, we're going to be talking about the 1995 movie Glory Days, the 1989 movie Beyond Dream's Door, and the 1986 movie Reform School Girls, so that should be a lot of fun. In the meantime, if you'd like to send us some feedback or talk to us or let us know what movies you'd like to see us cover on the show or like to give us some feedback on the interview this week, please send us an email at jfdpodcast@gmail.com. We'd really like to get some more feedback and read some of it out on the show. Also, you can look us up on Facebook and Twitter, follow us that way, and send us messages there as well. Also, on our webpage, you can find links to iTunes and Podcast Alley, where you can subscribe to the podcast and have it directly delivered to your iPod or mobile device. Also, if you have a few minutes, take some time to vote or comment on us on iTunes or Podcast Alley. Help spread the word about Junk Food Dinner and get us up in the rankings and get some more people listening to us. And if you like the podcast and you know somebody who you think might also like it, you know, tell a friend and spread the word that way. We'd really appreciate that. I'd also like to thank Christopher Olvis for taking time out and joining us this week and last episode as well. Much appreciated, Christopher.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, absolutely. Just keep your eyes on the blog, junkfooddinner.com, and we'll be updating that more often and get some crazy stories up there, and all the episodes can be found there as well. So until next time, this is Kevin Moss and Parker Bowman, Mark Fredo, and Christopher Olvis saying adios, everybody. We'll see you next time on Junk Food Dinner.
Hope you like reggae, you flea-bitten bastard.